This message comes from NPR sponsor, The Nature Conservancy. By working across communities, oceans, and isles, The Nature Conservancy is delivering solutions for the planet and building a future where people and nature thrive. Learn more at nature.org/solutions.
When you visit the doctor, they'll likely check your heart rate, measure your blood pressure, take your temperature. But if you're the doctor charged with assessing the health of the country, that's a daunting task. Being healthy in America these days looks a little different than it did in years gone by. So how do you check the country's bill of health and decide what issues need to be addressed? That's a question for the U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy, also known as the nation's doctor. Murthy has set a few priorities for this term. They include addressing loneliness, youth mental health, and health disinformation. Last week, he announced gun violence as a public health crisis.
It is a public health issue that merits a public health approach. And we've taken public health approaches to challenges like tobacco, car accident-related deaths over the years. And we've been able to reduce the toll of those public health challenges. We can do the same thing here with gun violence, and it's urgent that we do so.
After the break, we sit down with the U.S. Surgeon General to talk about how he's tackling the job this time around. I'm Jen White. You're listening to the 1A Podcast, where we get to the heart of the story. We'll be back with more in just a moment.
Support for NPR and the following message come from Betterment, the automated investing and savings app. CEO Sarah Levy shares how Betterment's innovation can help Americans save.
The real innovation for Betterment about a decade ago was taking a set of tools that were used by the ultra wealthy and making them accessible to the average investor. And that includes tax strategies, that includes dollar cost averaging, that includes taking a long-term view and not getting distracted by market volatility. These are all sort of tricks of the trade. And what Betterment did is they basically said, no matter the amount of money you have, it's always good to be invested. It's always good to start early. It's always good to save. And the power of being consistent in your habits is really the path to long-term wealth.
Learn more about automated investing and saving at Betterment.com. Investing involves risk. Performance not guaranteed.
Joining us now is the nation's doctor, U.S. Surgeon General Dr. Vivek Murthy. Dr. Murthy, thanks for being here.
Thanks so much, and it's good to be with you today.
Dr. Murthy, let's just start with last week. You declared gun violence a public health crisis. What led you to that announcement?
Well, Jen, I've been concerned about gun violence for years, ever since, as a doctor, I began seeing patients who were the victims of gun violence and suffering the physical and mental health consequences of these episodes. And as I became Surgeon General, especially during my second term, I began hearing a lot more from people around the country about the mental health toll of gun violence on their communities and on their families. And that's ultimately what led me to dig more deeply into the research. And what I came to understand is that in addition to the nearly 50,000 lives that we lose each year to gun violence, the mental health toll on the country is far greater than I think most people realize. Right now, 6 out of 10 people in America are worried about losing a loved one to gun violence. More than half of our kids are worried about a shooting taking place in their school. And more than half of Americans, about 54%, have either directly or through a family member actually experienced gun violence, whether that's losing a loved one, being threatened, being injured by a firearm. So the ripple effects, the cascade of harms, if you will, from gun violence are far greater than we realize. And that's one of the reasons I issued this report. I wanted people to know about the consequences of gun violence, but also lay out some solutions. Like, the truth is, we don't have to live like this, Jen. There's a path toward a more peaceful, more safe and secure future. That's something everybody wants. And that's something I believe what we can achieve.
Well, the advisory you released proposes a few strategies to mitigate gun violence. It includes safe storage laws, universal background checks, banning assault weapons and large capacity magazines for civilian use. How did you decide on these strategies?
Well, these strategies we came to looking at a combination of the evidence that's available, looking at also what the drivers were of the broader gun violence crisis that we're facing. And that's why, in addition to focusing solutions on firearm risk reduction, many of which you mentioned, we also actually have categories related to expanding research to help understand more deeply the drivers of gun violence and what solutions are most effective. And the truth is this area, gun violence, has been starved of research funding for nearly 30 years. We also call for a greater investment in community violence intervention programs, which have been proven to work, but we don't invest enough in them. And these are often hospital-based or broader community-based programs. But finally, we also call for an expansion in mental health access and care. It may surprise many people to know that 56% of gun violence-related deaths are, in fact, suicides. And when you combine that with the fact that the mental health toll of gun violence is so substantial in our country, that really makes you realize that we have to do much more to expand access to high-quality, affordable mental health care.
So you have these strategies, but what would it take for them to actually be implemented?
Well, some of these strategies can be implemented right now. When we think about some of the recommendations we have about safe storage education, for example, these are conversations that can begin right now in communities that healthcare systems can start to take on right now. You know, in the healthcare system, you know, we talk to patients all the time about safety-related issues. If you've got kids, you know, we'll ask about whether you have a swimming pool, you know, that may present a risk for drowning. If you've got kids at home, we may also ask you if you've got medication bottles around the house, and we want to make sure that those are stored safely and away from a kid's reach. There are conversations around safe storage that can happen as well, and that can happen relatively quickly. There are other solutions here that will take more effort and potentially take a little bit more time. For example, getting more research funding allocated to gun violence research is something that Congress can consider doing, but it's going to require Congress to act. Some of the firearm risk reduction strategies will also require lawmakers to consider taking these actions, and that will potentially take time as well. But the reason I wanted to put out this report is just to say that if you understand the toll of gun violence, if you also understand that this has now become the leading cause of death among children and adolescents age 1 through 19, then you start to realize we can't just treat this issue as business as usual and say, well, it'll take 3 to 5 years to put in place the kind of funding we need or the kind of measures we need from a policy or programmatic perspective. You know, I know as a father of two young kids that if you told me, Jen, that my kids were in danger today, I would pull out the stops to do everything possible to protect them, to make sure that they were okay. I think that I would do what most parents would do. What the data is telling us and what young people are actually telling us and telling me directly when I travel around the country is that they are worried about their safety, is that they are literally being injured and in some cases losing their lives to gun violence. And so that should prompt all of us to push aside business as usual practices and say, we've got to make this a priority because it's our kids' well-being that's at stake.
Many of you asked what government research can be done on gun violence because of the 1996 Dickey Amendment. The amendment states no federal funding for CDC research on injury prevention and control could be used to advocate for gun control. In 2011, that was expanded to include the National Institutes of Health. In 2018, Congress clarified that these organizations could conduct research on gun violence, but still not advocate for gun control. Dr. Murthy, what kind of research is currently being done on gun violence in the U.S.?
Well, the research is quite limited. And you're right that a few years ago, Congress did, for the first time in several decades, finally put some modest funding toward gun violence research. That was a really important first step forward. It was a bipartisan step, and that is a hopeful move, if you will. But just to give you a sense of how big the discrepancy is, if you look at another health condition that causes a similar number of lives lost each year to gun violence, a condition known as sepsis, which is related to bloodstream infections, right now gun violence receives 1% of the funding as sepsis, even though the number of deaths caused by these two situations are fairly similar. That just gives you a sense of how big a gap we've got to close here. So this is a place where I do think it's important for Congress to recognize that gap and to recognize that, look, the research we need is broad. We need research into prevention, into understanding what kind of measures help protect individuals and communities from violence, what kind of strategies work in terms of intervention, which groups are at highest risk in terms of age, race, ethnicity, geography. All of these will help us develop the most efficient and effective strategy to address gun violence. But the truth is, we've got to take action now based on the information we have. And that's why, while I call for additional research, I also lay out a series of strategies that we can consider and take today. Because the truth is, given the scale of gun violence, we can't wait to take action.
A quick clarification here, that 1996 Dickey Amendment was expanded in 2011 to include the National Institutes of Health. In 2018, it was expanded to clarify that these organizations could conduct research on gun violence but still not advocate for gun control. Dr. Murthy, gun safety is a heavily politicized issue in the U.S. I'm sure I don't have to explain that to you. But how do you expect congressional leaders and the White House to respond to this advisory?
Well, my hope is that they will look at this issue not as a political issue, but as a public health issue. That's a shift that we've got to make as a country. When we look at this as a public health issue, then that not only allows us to have a different conversation about it, but it unlocks a series of public health strategies, many of which I lay out in this advisory. Now, the truth is, we have done this before with other issues. If you think about smoking for a moment, back in 1964, when my predecessor, Surgeon General Luther Terry, issued the first Surgeon General's report on tobacco, at that time, there were a lot of politics around tobacco, but there was also this belief that it was just part of the culture of America and that that wasn't going to change. And you can understand why. 42% of the country smoked at that time. There were ads for smoking everywhere. Doctors were smoking. Sometimes they were in the ads. I mean, this was just everywhere. But what we did with that 1964 report is to reframe this as a public health concern. And that helped catalyze, over the years that followed, a series of measures from education programs in communities to advocacy programs among youth and parents to policy measures at a local, state, and federal level that ultimately brought smoking rates down from 42% to under 12% today. That's the power of a public health approach. It's what we did with cars, car accident-related deaths. We've done this in other areas as well. For some reason, we have allowed the issue of gun violence to be politicized, but now is time for us to put it back where it belongs, which is in the realm of public health.
Mm. Well, we got this message from Wanda in Omaha who says, I applaud Dr. Murthy's stance on gun violence in the country and wholeheartedly agree that it is a national health concern. I wonder if he has any optimism about this approach having a better outcome than other approaches that have been taken. Dr. Murthy?
Well, I certainly appreciate that sentiment, and I'll say I do feel optimism, and here's why. In addition to the move a few years ago from Congress to provide more research funding for gun violence, there was also 2 years ago the first major piece of gun violence legislation passed in the United States in nearly 30 years. That was a bipartisan Safer Communities Act that provided significant funding for helping to address some of the deeper root causes of gun violence. Now, there's a lot more that we have to do. No question. That's why I issued this advisory. But the fact that Congress was able to get together on a bipartisan basis and take these two very significant actions in recent years, that does give me hope. What also gives me hope are the conversations I'm having with people across our country, parents, educators, young people, doctors and nurses and healthcare professionals across America who are all realizing that this is not only a public health concern that's affecting them, but one in which their voices need to be heard. And they're using their voices to call for more change here. So I hope that what we can see here is the kind of movement building that we saw around tobacco, around drunk driving related deaths, around car accident deaths more broadly, that has helped us make real progress in saving lives. It's what we've got to do here as well.
We got this question from a member of our text club. What kind of education and policies will come from the announcement of gun violence as a public health crisis? Dr. Murthy, you make this announcement, you release this advisory. What are the next steps in your department after this?
Well, once we issue advisories like this, we typically bring it to communities. So we go across the country, we talk to communities about what's in this and what actions they can take. And the good news is that there are a lot of actions that we can take as a country. We have steps for healthcare organizations to take when it comes to education around safe storage. We have steps for hospitals as well that can help build and support hospital violence intervention programs, which again, proven to work. We have steps for community organizations that they can take, for schools, as well as for lawmakers to consider. So there are a number of steps here that we want people to know about And that's part of the work that we'll be doing in the coming months after this advisory.
But your work is mostly focused on education and providing options for organizations. You don't establish policy.
That's correct. The Office of the Surgeon General does not pass laws. We do not make laws, and that has been true for the history of the office. But what we do is shine a light on critical public health issues, make them priorities for the country, and help rally lawmakers and other members of the community around concrete solutions that can then ultimately help improve lives and save lives.
Another proposed solution in this advisory is to, quote, treat firearms like other consumer products. Explain that part of the advisory.
Sure. So we have safety measures that we put in place to ensure that many common everyday products that we use are in fact safe. Think about the food that you eat, the car seat that you may buy for a child when they're young. Think about the car that you buy and the safety measures, seat belts, airbags, and other measures that are included as part of those products. Many of those safety measures exist because we looked at these as consumer products and said, okay, there have to be measures that we put in place that ensure all of these products meet a certain threshold of safety. When we do that, we help everyone. We have an opportunity to do that with firearms as well. And that can help ultimately make firearms safer. Look, there is no shortage of ideas that people have had in recent years about how to reduce the chances that a firearm ends up being used to take a life. The challenge that we have is that we have been so thin in terms of regulation in this space that we haven't been able to apply these kind of safety standards, you know, across the board effectively. So treating a product as a consumer product allows you to put in place common sense safety requirements. And that's what we could do here, as we've done for many other products.
It's clear to me, Dr. Murthy, that you have a sense of urgency around this issue. Considering the fact that you don't create laws, you don't establish policy, how do you communicate that urgency to other institutions, to Congress, to the White House, to try to put some pressure on the people who actually do make the laws?
Well, you know, we do it in some ways the old-fashioned way. We talk to people. You know, we literally go to the Hill and meet with lawmakers on a variety of health issues. We do a lot of media interviews like this and others to help share messages with the community. But we also go into communities and meet with individuals. We do town halls. I meet with local elected officials, with lawmakers. I meet with institutions, healthcare organizations, YMCAs, faith organizations, anyone and everyone who can have a role in addressing the critical health issues that we're facing. And so that's the kind of groundwork that I think is necessary on issues like this. And historically, it's what our office has done and done effectively. And it's what we're working to do here as well.
Let's take a quick pause here. After the break, we talk about how the Surgeon General deals with health misinformation when public health is politicized. We'll be right back.
This message comes from NPR sponsor Capital One. The Capital One Venture X business card has no preset spending limit, so the card's purchasing power can adapt to meet business needs. Plus, the card earns unlimited double miles on every purchase, so the more a business spends, the more miles earned. And when traveling, the Venture X business card grants access to over 1,300 airport lounges. The Venture X business card, what's in your wallet? Terms and conditions apply. Find out more at CapitalOne.com/VentureXBusiness.
This message comes from Capital One, offering commercial solutions you can bank on. Now more than ever, your business faces unique challenges and opportunities. That's why Capital One offers a comprehensive suite of financial services, all tailored to your short and long-term goals. Backed by the strength and stability of a top 10 commercial bank, their dedicated experts work with you to build lasting success. Explore the possibilities at CapitalOne.com/commercial, a member FDIC. This message comes from NPR sponsor Viking, committed to exploring the world in comfort. Journey through the heart of Europe on an elegant Viking longship with thoughtful service, destination-focused dining, and cultural enrichment on board and on shore. And every Viking voyage is all-inclusive with no children and no casinos. Discover more at Viking.com.
Let's get to another one of your top priorities, Dr. Murthy. Last year, your office released an advisory about the effect of social media on children and adolescents. 96% of teens today say they use the internet every day, and the number of teenagers who are online, quote-unquote, almost constantly has almost doubled since 2014. 93% of teens use YouTube, 63% are on TikTok, 60% are on Snapchat, almost 60% use Instagram. That's according to Pew Research. Let's go to this message we got from one of you who writes, I feel strongly about lessening use of the internet for children and adults, especially social media. I think Dr. Murthy's recent recommendations are spot on. So much harm has been done by the internet. Dr. Murthy, you think it's time to require a warning label on social media platforms? And a member of our text club asks, what is the process to receive approval for and then implement warnings on social media?
Well, Jen, I think it's important to step back and understand why a warning is important. There is a youth mental health crisis taking place in our country right now, and social media has emerged as an important contributor to that crisis. It's not the only one, but it has become an important contributor to that crisis. This is an issue that I began hearing about almost from day one of my time as Surgeon General. The most common question parents are asking me is about social media, and they want to know, is social media safe for my kids? And that is ultimately what prompted me last year to issue a Surgeon General's advisory on social media and youth mental health. And what we found there are two critical things. Number one, that to the question parents are asking, there actually is not enough data for us to say that social media is safe for your kids. And that may be surprising to many parents who are used to thinking about car seats, baby food, other products that kids use, which generally have some safety standard associated with them. But the other thing we found was that there was growing evidence of harm associated with use. And that's why last year I called for a series of measures for Congress to take to make social media safer, to reduce the risk that young people would be exposed to violent and sexual content, that they would be exposed to bullying and harassment, and also that they would reduce the chances of them being exposed to features that would seek to manipulate their developing brains into excessive use that comes at the expense of their sleep, in-person interaction, and physical activity. A warning label, it turns out, is a complementary step that would help to inform parents and young people about the risks that we see. But it's part of a broader strategy that ultimately needs to make social media safer for our kids. Finally, the process of implementing a warning label requires Congress. Congress has to authorize that label. This has been the case with tobacco labels and alcohol labels. But this would be a digital warning label that would pop up regularly when people used their social media account. The frequency with which it popped up, the exact design of the label, whether there's a graphic component to it, that would be determined in a design phase that would be undertaken as part of a scientific process after Congress authorized the label.
Ideally, how do you see that label working as a warning? I'm thinking about the way young people in my life utilize social media, and it's often a solitary experience. So it's not as if a parent would see that label unless they were directly over the child's shoulder.
So this is a good point, and here's how I think about this. Like, number one, that the warning label, it's important for a child to see it. But when parents actually log into their own accounts, it's something that they would see as well. And just like if you think about alcohol warning labels, there are certain warning labels that that provide caution to women who are pregnant about drinking alcohol during pregnancy. Now, many people see that even if they're not pregnant, right? But it's there for everyone to see because even if we're not children ourselves, we may have children in our lives, you know, as parents, as grandparents, as aunts and uncles. The other important thing, though, Jen, to know is that there actually is evidence that warning labels work. And the good news here is that we have decades of experience with alcohol and tobacco labels that show us, particularly with tobacco, that they are effective in both changing awareness and changing behavior. So again, they are part of the solution, but they need to be accompanied by the other measures that I laid out last year that will ultimately reduce the chances that young people will be harmed on the platforms. We've got to make them safer.
I want to hear more about some of the other recommendations you made, but I return to how people tend to use social media and how quickly you can just swipe past something. So how would you research the best ways to ensure that this is a label that actually sinks in. You know, if there's a label on an alcohol bottle, sure, you can try to ignore it, but it's fixed. It's on the bottle. It's on the package of cigarettes. The digital world is a different beast.
It is a different beast, and that's actually why this scientific design process becomes so vital. Because in that process, which, by the way, we do with tobacco and alcohol labels as well, what you would do is, after Congress authorizes, you would test different designs and look at the impact on a population to see what kind of design, what kind of frequency of appearance, where, what location in terms of where the label appears on the digital screen would maximize your desired outcome, which is to increase awareness and drive behavior change. And so, yes, that process is really vital. You can't cut that out. And sometimes you're surprised in these design processes. Sometimes the design you think is going to generate the most awareness isn't actually the one that comes out on top. So that's the kind of scientific rigorous process that would be undertaken.
Let's go back to our voicemail box. This is a message we got from Meredith.
I would like the Surgeon General to even recommend it as with a warning for adults. And I would like for them to do that soon so we can hopefully try to get social media and cell phones, at least the accessibility of cell phones, out of public schools.
Hey, thanks for that message, Meredith. Dr. Murthy, how do you think about the social media impact on adults and whether it's harmful?
Well, that's such a good question from Meredith, because one of the most common responses I've received ever since we launched our advisory last year and the warning label recommendation this year has actually been from adults who say, yes, we need this for kids, but what about us? We're struggling too. The research that we have on social media's impact on adults is more thin than what we have on kids. And this is actually a place where I think not only do we need to study this more, but I think that there are also important requirements for data transparency that Congress needs to put in place for the social media platforms themselves. Jen, one of the most disturbing things that I hear from researchers around the world is that they're not able to get full access to the data on the impact of social media on youth mental health. They're not able to get this from the companies. Now, as a parent in particular, I don't want to feel that something that my child is using, that there's data about its impact on their minds, on their health, and their well-being that's being hidden from me. So that data transparency is important here. And I do think that it would also be helpful for us to be able to look at the data on impact on adults. Now, anecdotally, I will tell you that many of the impacts that we worry about with kids, you know, adults struggle with too. They also find themselves comparing themselves to other people constantly online, which makes them feel worse about themselves. They also find it's very hard to get off of social media once they start using it. So many people say, they go on saying, I'm going to check my feed for 5 or 10 minutes, and then an hour, hour and a half later, they're still there looking through an endless list of videos and posts from others. So there's also, I think, a broader impact on society that I worry about, which is the impact social media has had on our ability to dialogue with one another, on our social connection with one another, the replacement of what used to be in-person connection, largely with online connections, particularly for younger people, but also for older people, I think has been detrimental to our ultimate ability to build greater social connection. I think has contributed in aggregate to some of the loneliness and isolation we face today.
When I look at your advisory from last year on social media, you talk about the role tech companies should play in this space. What would you like to see from the companies themselves?
There's a lot that I'd like to see. Number one, I'd like to see transparency about what information they have about health impact on our kids. I'd like to understand the data they have about experiments they may have run to look at how changing features or putting in certain safety measures, how that actually impacts the health and well-being of kids. We hear all the time from tech companies that they're taking steps to make their platform safer. What I really care about as a parent, though, is are those steps working to ultimately keep my child safer? We don't see the data there. What I'd also like to see is for them to not use features that we know lead kids to excessive use. Think about infinite scroll, the autoplay on videos, the notifications, the like button. These are all things that keep kids coming back again and again and again. And here it's really important to underscore that kids are not just small adults. During adolescence, our brain is in a fundamentally different stage of development where we are more sensitive to social suggestion, social comparison, where our impulse control has not developed as much. And so when you have the best product engineers in the world, you're funded by some of the most resourced companies in the world, using cutting-edge brain science to figure out how to keep us on for as long as possible, and then you're asking a young person to just use the force of willpower to somehow resist being on for too long a time, that is the definition of an unfair fight. It's an unreasonable expectation. And that is, unfortunately, contributing to so much guilt and shame that young people feel today. When I just finished a college tour and talking to young people across the country, this came up everywhere I went. Young people brought it up themselves, saying that they struggle with managing social media in their lives. They recognize some of the benefits, but they also recognize the harms. And we feel like when they're not able to manage those harms, that it's a personal failure. And that is just not the case. They are the victims of a broader digital environment that is not healthy and that's doing them harm.
Well, let's go back to our voicemail box.
A lot of your goals focus on America's mental health and mental health crises going on right now. My question is, how are we going to bring focus and funding to mental health care providers and break down the stigmas around mental health in America?
Thanks for that question. Dr. Murthy, what challenges are there to breaking down that stigma and bringing focus and funding to mental health care?
Well, this is a place where I actually do feel quite optimistic because we've made a lot of progress in recent years. There is still stigma, still a sense of shame that people feel in admitting they're struggling with their mental health or with getting help. But thanks in large part to young people, to a generation that's pushing all of us to think and talk differently about mental health, that stigma is a lot less now than it was 5-10 years ago. What we're also seeing is growing bipartisan support in Congress and also at a local state level to invest in mental health. In the last 3 years, I have seen more investment in mental health than I have seen in nearly 30 years of being in public health. And so that is progress. That's progress that's resulted in more access to care, more affordability of care, more requirements for insurance companies to actually cover mental health care. Now, finally, the establishment of 988, a crisis line that you can call or text at any point for a mental health emergency. Is there more to do? Absolutely. And that's one of the reasons I've made mental health and well-being the focus of my time as Surgeon General. But the progress we've made in the last few years in particular gives me hope that we can do more to increase access to care and to ultimately get at the root causes of what's driving so much of our mental health struggles, including social media, loneliness and isolation, and frankly, the barrage of negative headlines and news that young people tell me that they're inundated with every day.
Well, we heard from many of you about health mis- and disinformation. One of you asks, what is it going to take to return the nation to a trust in science? And another texted, how do you deal with the massive number of Americans who don't believe in science? Dr. Murthy, how much of your role is focused on restoring trust in science and combating disinformation?
Well, that's certainly an important part of the role, and it's one that I share with other scientific agencies, health agencies, across government and even outside of government, you know, in academia, departments of health and, in major health systems that are focused on public health more specifically. But look, the truth is this is one of the challenges that I'm deeply worried about, because what we're facing today in terms of the spread of misinformation is very different from what we faced even during my first term as Surgeon General back in 2014, 15, 16. Back, now what we're seeing, and we saw this front and center with COVID, is it is so easy for misinformation to spread. And when you have algorithms that amplify, content and posts that generate anger or outrage or that are extreme in nature, that can often contribute, sometimes unintentionally, to the spread of misinformation. I also think, though, that trust in some ways has moved closer to the ground, if you will. People still trust people, but I think they tend to look to people that they are around, their doctors, their nurses, their family, their friends, the institutions they may be a part of, like faith institutions. They tend to look to them for information, for guidance. And I think that puts the onus on all of us as people in the world of public health to say, how can we work more closely with local organizations and institutions recognizing the role that they all will have increasingly in sharing information through their trusted relationships. So there's a lot of work to do here. I do worry a lot about misinformation. It's also one of the reasons I think we have to all be very careful about what we share online, because a lot of times we inadvertently share information that looks legitimate, but might actually be incorrect and may cause harm.
Well, that's U.S. Surgeon General Vivek Murthy. Dr. Murthy, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you so much. It was good to be with you today, Jen.
Today's producer was Jorgelina Manarea. This program comes to you from WAMU, part of American University in Washington, distributed by NPR. I'm Jen White. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk more soon. This is 1A.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, The Nature Conservancy. By working across communities, oceans, and isles, The Nature Conservancy is delivering solutions for the planet and building a future where people and nature thrive. Learn more at nature.org/solutions.
This message comes from NPR sponsor, Homes.com. You don't just live in your home, you live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, local amenities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.